Let us talk about tonight's films. Breakout Irish language hit on Colleen Kuhn. Catherine Clinch is caught. The quiet girl of the title sent to stay for a summer with relatives Eileen and Sean, played by Carrie Crowley. And Andrew Bennett is the other actor in there as well, based on Claire Keegan's novella Foster. Next up is Vortex from the Argentinian director Gaspar Noé. This is the story of an elderly couple in Paris dealing with the day-to-day challenges of serious health problems, including dementia. And finally, Father Stew, Marky Mark, Mark Wahlberg himself, as a former boxer who heads for the bright lights of Hollywood but falls in love and becomes a priest. Mel Gibson plays his alcoholic father. With me this evening, Chris Wasser and Deirdre Malumbi. And let's start with on Colleen Kuhn. We had Andrew Bennett, who plays the character of Sean, and Kate Nicconini, who plays the mother of the young Corch character. Mm-hmm. We had them on the program on the show with us on Monday. Just remind us of the basic setup here, Deirdre.
Yeah, so basically we have a 9-year-old little girl named Corch. She is this very shy, this withdrawn little girl. She gets very little attention or indeed affection from her family, and she is sent away to spend the summer with her aunt Evelyn and her husband Sean. She gradually kind of just comes out of her shell and really comes into her own under their care. So in many ways, this is a very kind of sweet and simple film. It clocks in at about 90 minutes long, but the quality of this movie is absolutely amazing. It ended up absolutely sweeping at the IFTAs this year. It won 7 awards in total. It won a number of technical awards, I believe, for editing, for music, because, I mean, it just looks so incredible. Mm. But it also swept away for Best Director, Best Lead Actress for Catherine Clinch, who's really incredible in this, and Best Film. It even beat out the multi-Oscar nominee Belfast in the process, and I think kind of deservedly so, because there's some thing about this movie, it's just such a perfect little film. I loved
it. It's a real gem. Let's have a listen to a clip from early on. In fact, this is the moment when Corch arrives at the farm of her mother's cousin. Corch, as you said, played by Catherine Clinch. She's coming to stay with the Kinsel as a couple. She barely knows, in fact, barely remembers them. Eileen here is played by Carrie Crowley, and she comes out to greet her.
Well, yeah. Erin Galin, sir.
Shasamach, good hour, Miss Blechy Carter.
And Tom Derrick, a Bacchus Tosser. It was a Fram, who is got a shin?
Tom Fram wished.
Oh, got a harlequin, eh, Carter?
This little drift came, Mer Barra, of a sage candle, and Rahia.
There we go. Catherine Clinch and Carrie Crowley there in a scene from early on in the film on Colleen Kuhn. And the Irish is, I don't think it's very difficult Irish. It's well subtitled and very easy to follow. But I think it's quite simple because the emotional content really is so strong. You don't need a lot of guidelines here.
Yeah, it is quite Chris. Simple. It's a simple story, beautifully told. And also, you know, the clues in the title and also some of the things that Andrew Bennett-Sean tells Kosh throughout this film, that you don't always need to say something. And it's often the things that you don't say that leave a bigger, that have a bigger impact on your life.
Because there's a secret that we're not going to talk about.
We're not going to talk about it. No.
From the past.
That's the thing. Because this girl, this young girl that Catherine Clinch plays, she has been neglected for most of her life. And she comes from this family. There's an awful lot of siblings. They're all quite unloved. You know, the father's a bit of a bozo. He's a waste of space. He kind of drinks and gambles all the money that he earns. And she's sent to this home because it's almost as though they can't afford to keep her. But Carrie Crowley and Andrew Bennett's character, they treat this child with, you know, the care, you know, the conversation, the love that she deserves. And I think, you know, it's about the space in between the cracks for me in this film, because often, far too often, you have an Irish film, you see it too often in Irish films, that dialogue is always a bit too stagey. It's always a bit too stilted. And the, you know, Irish dramas, they're very talky. They never shut up, Sean. Hmm. But this one, it knows when to speak, and it knows the power of allowing actors to basically inhabit the characters they're playing, and, you know, showing you how they feel without telling you all the time how they feel. And I think this does it very, very well.
And the trio really at the head of this, there's nothing between them, Catherine Clinch, Carrie Crowley and Andrew Bennett, except that Catherine Clinch has no acting experience. The other two are very experienced actors. But it's an extraordinary dynamic that's built up in that little
Absolutely.
Unit.
Yeah. The ensemble acting is really amazing in this. Crowley and Bennett give really powerful performances. But oh my gosh, like Catherine Clint, she just absolutely steals the show.
She's
so shy. She's so sweet. She's so insecure. And your heart just pours out for her. Because I think like even I can relate to, you know, remembering being that little girl and kind of not knowing like my place in this, you know, big wide world and everything. And she's so sweet as well, because she's like working on this farm and she's kind of, you know, trying to like work her way into, you know, the hearts of these two adults. You know, she's never kind of known this like real love in her life. And I mean, she's even such a hard little worker. Like you can see she really wants to, you know, put in the labor and put in the work at the farm. And she's just all the more kind of admirable for that. And she's just so dedicated and sweet. And she's an incredible actress. I believe she's from Rathmines in Dublin. And I think she's going places after this. She's brilliant.
The basis of this is a very strong acting life ahead of her. However, there are also bits of fun and nice little bits of gentle nastiness in the film as well. Mm. And one of the moments that really stood out for me in that respect was there's been a funeral. And after the funeral, the Kinsella's nosy neighbour, Una, is played by Joan Sheehy, says, "Oh, I'll bring her home." So she's walking Koch, played by Catherine Clint, home. And by God, is she quizzing her as they go.
Cooker. Then she'll run a horsey too.
And Kiana can Irish.
Are they going to share a good poke with it? And Kinsella?
Oh, share a good domino.
Not Riven Thorth. Give it.
Punt.
And we'll kill the key shoe, don't I get the calf?
Okay.
Eileen a flyka.
Oh.
I guess being she go holy go on the estocha.
And they're a hugging courtory.
I mean more on courtory a con.
We clear courtory a con and chuck the chugata.
I guess give you on.
First chair, I guess far I like a con and get the linty.
Linty?
The dean a car in skull.
And earn she one coron with her?
Neither.
I guess being she a balk all he go, nae nach mean.
Bean?
I'm no margarine.
Care?
It's a taste, Ronicky.
I'm.
Oh, I love that question just at the very end there of that clip. Joan Sheehy as the neighbour Una, and Catherine Clinch as the young girl. Does she do a lot of baking, and does she use margarine or butter? The judgment that's all over it. But the innocence of the little girl and the way Catherine Clinch plays that so simply. Extraordinary poise.
It is extraordinary. And you'd never know that she was a newcomer. You'd never know that she has no experience on screen whatsoever. And I think for Colin Barre, the director, and everyone involved in this, casting was so integral. You needed, you know, this film would not work without an actor like Catherine Clinch at the centre of it, because you need a strong performer to hold everyone and indeed everything in place. And I think she does that almost effortlessly. I know an awful lot of work went into this, but she makes it look effortless. But I think for me, a standout performer in this was probably Andrew Bennett, an actor who I've admired for a long time. But his transformation in this film, his character Sean, is startling too, because when we first meet him, you know, he's this aloof farmer, a man of few words, who, you know, doesn't seem to kind of he doesn't seem too excited about the idea of A, Catherine's dad coming to visit, and B, him leaving the child behind. But we start to see him warm to her, because, you know, you'd have to have a heart of stone not to warm to this child. And it's the little things he does when he's walking, you know, when we first meet him, he's hunched over, he's got this, you know, expressionless, you know, he's not a very happy man. But every day that passes, he's leaving a biscuit on the table for the kid. He lets her try a sip of his Guinness. All of these, he just starts to come alive, basically.
Yeah, I spoke with Andrew Bennett on the program earlier in the week, and I said to him, I hope I can get through this interview without blubbering. And now, as you're describing the film, I think I hope I can get through this review without blubbering as well. Andrew Bennett is extraordinary. I want to listen to one clip just before we talk about the director himself. Let's listen to the clip that features Andrew Bennett. And this whole idea of, you know, you don't have to say things, which is a great lesson in filmmaking.
Ní gádach é rud rá. Cuíne gair sin a gónaí. Zomí dina nár hógan deis a bhéalach am adúnta. Is a chail mór an dá bhár.
You don't have to say anything. I mean, it's such wonder, and it's a wonderfully quiet scene between Andrew Bennett and Catherine Clinch in that scene from Colleen Kuhn. And Andrew said to me on Monday night about Colin Braid, who's the director here, and who has adapted the screenplay from the novella. He said to me, he's a quiet guy, but this is of Colin Brady. He's a quiet guy who knows what he wants and who knows when he isn't getting it.
Absolutely.
So the direction here is, well, was flawless to me.
I think that title of the movie, On Colin Kuhn, the whole idea of quietness, the whole idea of language and communication is so integral to this movie. And it's really woven throughout this film on every level, from the fact that, you know, you have the Irish language. But even, you know, something about this movie, like even, you know, it kind of reminds me of, you know, the film WALL-E in a way, how there's so much that goes on in that initial scene between the two robots that they only say like kind of a few words to each other. So much of it is that kind of physical language and like communication and gestures and looks and stuff like that. Like On Colin Kuhn reminds me of that, or like something like, you know, early silent classical cinema. So I think that really you can go and watch this film, even you don't even need the subtitles, you know, which I think is another testament to its strength.
I mentioned this to Kate Nicanini on Monday night as well. She plays the mother of Koch, the woman who has to kind of send her off for this summer to her cousins.
Yes.
In that household, she, the mother and the father, speak English to each other.
They do.
And he's, Michael Patrick plays that father character, and he's kind of a bit of an outsider. And that use of the two languages, I thought that said loads as well.
It does, yeah. And just the way it's photographed as well, it's quite bleak and grey. And we get this, you know, dour and dire portrait of 1980s Ireland when Koch is still at home with her mother and father, and just how the sun literally comes out when she goes to live with Evelyn and Sean. I think it might be, there's an awful lot of talk about, you know, how Irish language cinema is having a bit of a moment following on the back of the release of the likes of Fosca of Erect. It is having a bit of a moment, and there's an awful lot of talk about how this might be, you know, the best Irish language film ever made. I think that's fair enough, but I also think it might be the best Irish film ever made, because we don't often get films of such, you know, rare quality and depth, where the performances are spot on, the storytelling is simple but again beautifully told, and, you know, as I said, beautifully photographed, exquisitely scored. It's just complete, and we don't get these kinds of films often, so we should celebrate them when they do arrive.
For sure. Stars, Chris?
It's flawless. It's just fabulously assembled. It broke my heart. It just put a huge smile on my face, and I just wish Catherine Clinch all the best for the future. Yeah. I think she has such a wonderful career ahead of her. 5 out of 5.
5. Deirdre?
Yeah, there's a tenderness to this movie that I found just completely irresistible, and I think you'd be really hard pressed to find an audience member who isn't deeply, deeply moved by this. So 5 out of 5 stars from me as well.
Yes, and if I were allowed, I'd be doing the very same thing. However, 2 fives is what we get, and most deservedly so, I think, for On Colin Kuhn. Let us move on then to we're talking about in the first film about a young girl coming of age in rural Ireland, and we move it to Vortex then, where we have two people at the other side of life, coming towards the end of their lives, actually, in the case of an elderly couple whose names we don't even learn. This is the film from Gaspar Noé, Chris.
It is a film from Gaspar Noé. It's probably one, well, I'm very happy to report that there is no violence in here, and it's a lesson. It's not as nasty as his previous films. You know, he is the enfant terrible of French cinema. You know, his films are notorious for their, you know, controversial content, where, you know, you've got people literally walking out of screenings of the likes of, you know, Climax or Irreversible, you know, when they screen the Cannes. This one is a film that he devised after suffering a cerebral hemorrhage in 2020. And he wanted to make a film about what, you know, life looks like for this elderly couple that he dreamt up in his head, who are living out their last days together. They've had this long, sometimes arduous marriage together. They live in this Parisian apartment that's just cluttered from wall to wall. Yeah. It kind of symbolizes the kind of life they've had together. And one of them has succumbed to the ravages of old age and dementia, and how that affects their life, you know, for Dario Argento's husband character, you know, what he, you know, how it affects him in terms of, does he understand how sick his wife is? And then in terms of Francois Lebrun's character, how it completely, you know, how we see that she completely starts to lose her grip on reality.
And she was a psychiatrist, and he is a filmmaker, a writer of some kind. But what's very interesting in this, it's a very slow movie. It's a very long movie, Deirdre, for sure. But a lot of it is in split screen, and the split screen is a big part of the storytelling here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, it's kind of the themes reflecting the actual like look of the film and everything. So it's a split screen technique, which I believe Noé has used in at least one, possibly a couple of his movies before. And what you have is each character is kind of confined to their half of the screen. So it's interesting because it kind of forces this couple together. They share the one screen, but it also kind of symbolizes how they're ultimately emotionally and psychologically basically splits. So certainly it's a very interesting technique to watch. And I think that it keeps, it gives the film kind of a sense of momentum where it is very slow moving and very long and stuff
like
that.
Yeah, because that sense of momentum, for example, we don't need to say which of them is suffering from the heart condition, which of them is suffering from the ravages of dementia.
Yeah.
But you see, say if it's the character who may be about to have a heart attack and you see the other character asleep or not doing, you think, no, you need to be awake and watching that character in case something happens to them.
Oh, absolutely.
So there's this tension, despite the fact that it's a it's fly on the wall stuff and you're watching somebody washing the dishes, walking around, you know, lifting their glasses, doing nothing essentially.
Yeah, I think that the split screen is definitely important to make sure it's not just very mundane, because that's just it. It is just kind of everyday activities. And then you kind of have another layer that kind of comes into the movie when their son arrives, and their son is very much trying to, you know, insist that the wife goes to a home where she can properly be taken care of, because her husband is simply too, you know, feeble himself to look after her. Even though he's like, no, you're going to make me leave too. This is my home and stuff like that. And again, the split screen is very clever in the way it kind of aligns the son with either, you know, his father or mother.
Depending on what argument
he's
making. Exactly,
yeah. So it was very kind of compelling that way as well. And then you've got the grandson as well, who's kind of playing with the cars in the background and being very distracting and annoying. But kids will be kids.
Yeah, but is it relentless in terms of, I mean, these two older people are heading in one direction, really, and that can be difficult to watch. And I wondered sometimes, were we a little bit exploited around that kind of trajectory?
Oh, I agree.
As viewers.
Yeah, and it is relentless. It's almost 2.5 hours long. So that's an awful lot of existential dread and terror for me. And especially an awful lot of stuff where nothing is really happening. The split screen technique for me, it worked as an idea more than, I more the idea more than the execution. You know, this idea that this couple have been together their whole life. They are intrinsically bound, you know, but and also the split screen technique is used while they're in the same apartment together. So it's just showing us that, you know, their lives have begun to drift apart. But it doesn't really make any sense later on in the film when Stefan gets his own frame.
This is
the son, Alex Lutz, who I think is exceptional here, as is Francois Lebrun. But I thought Stefan, whenever he came into the scenes, whenever, you know, the mother and father are with him, I thought those scenes really, you know, made this film come alive. But it doesn't really make any sense later on when he gets his own frame, because it's supposed to be about the two of them drifting apart.
And I wondered, did we need the son character to a large extent? Is, you know, like the Haneke film Amour, where we just saw the two people, I think, for the most part during that film. I wanted to see the two of them out. I didn't really want anybody else interrupting their lives, or, you know, I could take a little minute of somebody like the shopkeeper or something like that, but that was it. I didn't want more than that.
Yeah, but then I'm also thinking, like, 2 hours and 20 minutes of just them would have been even more painful.
Maybe, though,
we wouldn't
have had that. It took a lot of time to tell his story.
But That's true.
I think actually one of the places it falls down is he's very good, and the son is a very good component of this story when you hear that he's an addict himself and he has his own struggles and he's trying to help mum and dad. Where it falls down, and this is a big problem with Gaspar Noé's film, is that he has basically told us about all of this stuff happening in the background. Then he spends half an hour at the end of this film showing us, and we were invited into Stefan's life, and it's just too much.
Yeah.
It's far too much.
Did it work overall for you, Deirdre?
I found it very painful to watch, if I'm honest. It reminded
painful,
me...
like as in... Just a bad watch.
Just really unpleasant, to be honest. I mean, I thought that cinematically it was quite beautiful, actually, but I just found it so torturous to watch. Like, I felt like watching this, it reminded me a lot of Requiem for a Dream, where you're watching it and you know that you need to kind of watch it to the finale and see, you know, the inevitable conclusion that these characters are going to go through. But you're also like in the back of your head, I'm never watching this movie again. It's just too grueling. It's very, very bleak.
Stars?
I mean, like, as a piece of cinema, I'd probably give it like something like 4 stars. I do think that it's really kind of beautiful and compelling. But as a piece of entertainment, I'd give it 2.5, because it's just bleak.
Yeah, and it is. I mean, you can't find yourself not being able to turn it off, despite the fact that it's 2.5 hours long. Stars overall from you, Chris.
There's a lot to admire in there. Francois Lebrun's performance is incredible, but I think the split screen technique detracts from that performance, which is a shame. And Dario Argento is the same, but the split screen just takes away. Again, Sean, I just had a problem with the format of it. It's just too much dread for me. Something special in there, but too much of it. So I'm going to go with 2.5.
All right, 2.5. Let's move on to our final movie, Father Stew. Mark Wahlberg, loosely based on a true story. story about a boxer forced to out of the ring by health problems who winds up finding that he has a religious vocation and he falls in love along the way as well. Nobody else could play this role other than Mark Wahlberg, I think. Oh,
absolutely. And the interesting thing about it is that it was a real passion project from him. So he was kind of first attached to this film back in 2016, and he ended up reportedly sinking millions of dollars into it because the shoot kept going over schedule. They were also bickering over rights to the music, and actually it's a terrific soundtrack. It really does slap. But Wahlberg also, like, he gained 30 pounds in 6 weeks to portray the character kind of towards the end of his life. So it's just, yeah, I mean, you can absolutely see Mark Wahlberg through his performance, absolutely how he wanted to give this, you know, real life person justice, you know.
Let's have a listen to a clip featuring the aforementioned Mark Wahlberg. Ash Wednesday, Father Stu is visiting a class taught by Teresa Ruiz, who's playing the character of Carmen, and the children ask them both, what are they giving up for Lent?
For example, I am going to give up chocolate.
Hey, you guys should protest. She needs sweetening.
Yeah, pick something else.
Well, what are you going to give up, Stu?
Me? I was thinking maybe you guys, so I could sleep in on Sundays.
No!
All right. Alcohol.
Hey, that's not fair. You got to pick something good that you'll miss to make it count.
I like this kid.
And that's Mark Wahlberg as a very nice Father Stewart, has to be said. Is this a kind of a rose-tinted spectacles type of look at this young priest and how he's redeemed himself in his life?
Oh, absolutely not. No, tone-wise, this film is all over the place, actually. That's one of the lighter moments. But I will say, actually, it does employ a sense of humour, and it does kind of make use of Mark Wahlberg's comic chops, because an awful lot is said about Mark Wahlberg, but I think, you know, we don't say this often enough, that, like, he is actually a very funny comedy yeah. actor. But there's so much story here, Sean. I'm not going to give, like, even half of it away, but the basic idea is that, you know, he is playing this boxer who was past his peak in the early 90s. He needed to do something else with his life, if not, you know, just because he was going to retire, but also his body was falling apart. And for some strange reason, he decides, I'm going to head out west to Hollywood and become an actor. And while he's there, reconvenes with, you know, his dad, played by Mel Gibson, who's an alcoholic who kind of went AWOL after a family tragedy. He meets a Catholic girl and falls in love. She wants nothing to do with him unless he finds God. And he also gets run over in such a way that would kill anybody, but this guy is Mark Wahlberg.
It's Mark Wahlberg.
And after being run over, has an epiphany and decides to become a priest. I'm telling you all that, and that sounds like an awful lot of plot. That's not even the half of it.
Does it work? And what about the parents? I mean, amazing. Mel Gibson and Jackie Weaver.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well because Mel Gibson has previously played Mark Wahlberg's dad in Daddy's Home 2. And there is something I think a bit pointed about the casting there, because I think people will know Mel Gibson basically kind of founded his own Catholic chapel.
Very traditional style Catholic, isn't it?
Yeah. It's kind of a weird one called the Holy Family in California. So I think there was, like, maybe a bit of a kind of wink to the audience with that particular casting. But I mean, Jackie Weaver, she's always been a very kind of, you know, like Mark Wahlberg, just a very kind of naturally charismatic actor. So I think that the casting is very good in this. I'd agree with Chris in that tonally, it is a bit all over the place. I think the first half of the film almost plays out better because it's so conventional and so Hollywood in a way. And then with the second half of the film, when it's getting into kind of the more spiritual aspect and when it's kind of trying to depict Catholicism, it gets quite simplistic and it doesn't quite know exactly what it's doing. But I mean, it has been praised by a number of Catholic leaders. It's been praised, you know, extensively by Stuart Long's own family, which I think is really important because there are still too many biopics to this day that aren't being made kind of with the consent of the right people and that are inaccurate.
Stars from you, Deirdre.
I'm going to give this 3 out of 5. I don't think it's a movie that's going to blow the world over, but it's sweet and it's entertaining.
Sweet and entertaining. Chris?
Yeah, I think it's structurally disorganized, sketchy, and it hasn't a clear which lane to pick, but at the same time, Jackie Weaver, always reliable. Mel Gibson acting for a change is quite solid, and Mark Wahlberg does bring, you know, some good comedic chops to it, so it was never boring. Sean, 3 stars.
Very solid three from both of you then. That's Father Stu, middle film we were talking about, Vortex, and No Doubt, about which the winner of the competition this evening was, on Colleen Kuhn, Deirdre Malumbi and Chris Wasser talking to us about our 3 film releases. And Colleen Kuhn is in cinemas this weekend, so I'd say you might need to get moving if you want to see that one. May 1972, the Rolling Stones released their 10th studio album, Exile on Main Street. The album was the culmination of a five-year productive frenzy, but it had also been one of the darkest periods in the group's history. Previous years had seen the death of Brian Jones and the chaos of Altamont Speedway Free concert, which ended with four people dead, including a murder captured live on film. And yet, amidst all of this, the Stones produced the albums Let It Bleed and Sticky Fingers, which featured songs like Gimme Shelter, Brown Sugar and Wild Horses. For Exile on Main Street, the Stones fled to the south of France because of tax troubles in England, settling at a mansion that was once a Gestapo HQ during World War II. The recording sessions have become infamous and ingrained in rock and roll folklore. Pat Carty is here to tell us more. But before we talk about the album, let's just hear how the album opens there. It opens with the track Rocks Off. There we go, Rocks Off, which is the opening track on the Rolling Stones album Exile on Main Street. As I said, Pat Carty with me in studio this evening. You know, when this album came out first, Pat, people kind of said, yeah, whatever. Then as time went on, some people said, this might be the best album that the Rolling Stones have ever made. You're going much further than that.
I am going much further than that. I'm going to be reserved, first of all. I'm going to say, first of all, that it's the greatest record ever made, bar none. And I don't mean just throwing stones. And I'm holding myself back there because what I really want to say is that this is probably the pinnacle of all human achievement, this record here. You could talk, listen, I know we went to the moon and everything, but, you know, there was nobody there, so what was that all about? This is the greatest thing humanity has ever done. Yeah,
that's a big claim now, so we better start backing it up. Yeah, so, well, let's start with the introduction to the recording sessions for this album. I mean, it's rock and roll folklore, this trip to the south of France. Why were they? Was it just money that sent them off to the south of France? Tax?
Pretty much, yeah. They had a manager called Alan Klein in the 60s who also worked at the Beatles. Now, Alan Klein, without trying to libel myself, was not the most honest man that ever drew a breath. He's no longer with us. But so he signed up the Stones. He renegotiated their Decca contract and got them the best record contract in the world at the time, better than the Beatles. But he was keeping all the money. And he also decided he wouldn't bother the taxman too much by annoying him with checks and things like that. So eventually the Stones realise this. Mick Jagger realises he's no money at all. You know, to buy anything, they had to go cap in hand to this fella, and often he turned them down. So they got rid of him. Court cases were ongoing, but they owed all this tax. Now, the tax at the time was in the 80%, and on investments it brought it up to in the 90% for artists and people like that in England. So they had to leave just to make the money to be able to pay back what they owed Her Majesty anyway in the first place.
Right.
So France was nearby. Jagger spoke a bit of the language. Sun was shining. Why not?
Yeah, off they go. But although I love this idea, you know, that they were very broke. They were very broke, but yeah, no, broke is one thing for one man. It's something very different if you're Keith Richards in particular. Where did he... Obviously, he had the money to... Tell us the place that he had bought in the south of France. Well, extraordinary.
He didn't buy it, but an assistant was sent, or letters were sent out to French estate agents looking for these places down in the south of France, for the five of them now, five Rolling Stones, and they all settled in different places. Charlie bought the house that he lived in and kept it all his life, apparently.
All right.
But Keith rented this place called Nelcott, which is in Villefranche-sur-Mer, which is just on the Mediterranean, just up the road from Nice and Marseille, in between the two of them. And it was in 1972, it was £1,000 a week, the rent.
1972, £1,000 a week.
A nice even £1,000.
Kind of like Dublin rent nowadays.
A bit like that, yeah, maybe a bit cheaper. But it was sold, in, I think, in 2006 to a Russian chap for something like 128 million.
Right. So, they could manage. They could manage to pay the rent. And what did this particular place give them in terms of its ambience, in terms of the building itself? Obviously, there was little or no recording equipment there. They had to start getting all of that over.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they looked around at a few studios in France, but didn't really find anything they wanted. Now, Keith Richards was maybe an unreliable character, so if they could record in the house that he was living in, the caught amongst the other band members as well. He doesn't have much of an excuse if he only has to come down the stairs. And the Stones also owned a mobile recording studio at this stage called the Rolling Stones Mobile. The same mobile that Led Zeppelin would record part of Led Zeppelin 4 on. Smoke on the Water was recorded on this mobile. So they drove this down to France, plugged it in, allegedly took some of the power from the French railway mains illegally. That's another story that goes along with it. And the basement of the basements, of this building, which, as you mentioned in the introduction, was a Gestapo headquarters during the war. So when they were in this basement, on some of the vents, there were still swastikas carved into the wall and things like that. You know, you could see these here. You can see those in the photos that are taken at the time. So what they did was they had this truck parked outside, and then the different rooms of the basement that have the horn players in one room, the piano player in another room, they might record the guitar in the kitchen upstairs. The drums would be out in the hall. And that's how they built on what they had already.
Yeah, we listened to the opening track, which is Rocks Off, and I mean, good solid rock and roll, but it's not all rock and roll across this album. There are different sounds in there, and I'm just wondering where they came from and what your opinions are on them. Let's have a listen to a track called Tumbling Dice. Tumbling Dice there from the album Exile on Main Street. 50 years old. In fact, exactly 50 years old today, because it was the 12th of May 1972 that it was released. And Pat Carty speaking to us about the album in studio this evening. And I was saying, as that was playing Tumbling Dice, it has that kind of country rock feel to it. Some might even say it's Touch of the Eagles in there, Pat, which would make you scream, I'm sure.
I've never heard anyone say that before. I'm going to refute that straight away. I think what it is...
It has that country rock sound to it. You're saying this is the pinnacle of human achievement, remember?
I am, but I don't know why you tarnish it with mentioning the Eagles. But anyway, going forward from that, I think it's got a combination of country, you know, rock and roll, soul, blues, basically everything that they had been listening to since they had met, you know, 10 years before on the train station or whatever it was. And with something like that as well, what you hear on that song... Well, first of all, thinking about that song, I mean, it slows down a bit towards the end. It's got this great coda. The verses and the chorus are not of any set length. They stretch out, you know, just as the players. So it's all about the feel and the groove they get going. A lot of that is in Charlie Watts' drums, and a lot of it is in the way Keith Richards played the guitar. Now, he discovered this different guitar tuning. He'd borrowed it, shall we say, from Roy Cooter, which is open G. So he hits the strings of the guitar. It plays a G chord. And then by hammering on two fingers, you know, he can go from the first to the fourth to the fifth chord, and that's where all these riffs come out of. So the descending riff at the start of that, that's in open G. And then the way the chords are slightly behind the beat, you know, that drags behind the beat, that gives that sound. And then also, of course, the genius, Mick Jagger on the top, who doesn't get enough credit for this stuff at all.
I want to stick with Keith Richards for the time being, because all of their lives were in interesting places at this particular moment in time. Where was Keith's life at? And, I mean, where was he at in terms of drug addiction and dealing in that area of his life?
Well, the story goes that he cleaned up a bit before he left England. And he was the last one to leave England and left on the very last day of the tax year. He didn't want to go at all. So left on whatever it was, 4th of April, and had to be dragged to the airport, apparently. But he cleaned up a small bit to try and avoid hassle with legal hassle and things like that. But what happened when it was not long after he arrived in France, he went go-karting, of all things, and had a spill. And had a lot of the skin scraped off his back, very painful. So to get over that, there was a few methadone injections, and that was one thing led to another, and then there you go. So the stories about, you know, various different books about how he lived in Nellcott, that he would get up in the morning. His son was only 2 years old, 1 or 2 years old at the time he was there. So he'd get up in the morning, look after his son, might even do a bit of water skiing. That's one book. Now, the other side is, he'd fall out of bed, he'd take a downer or two, and then he'd shoot up before having his breakfast at about 2 p.m.
So there are lots of versions of it.
So, you know, and I think you have to take some of that with a bit of a pinch of salt, because this record, you know, this record comes out of that. So
and
there was work done.
Where was Mick Jagger at? Had he just, himself and Bianca, were they expecting their first child at this point in time?
Yeah, they got married, I think, in April or May of that year, and that was a circus. That was kind of like an OK magazine wedding before such a thing existed. And, you know, the Stones were there. She didn't she didn't like the atmosphere at Nellcott, so she didn't want to be there. So he didn't, you know, he would disappear sometimes because she was pregnant. You know, she just got married, and Keith would give out. But while he was in Paris with her, he was also planning the Stones' next move, you know, the next tour and all that, because that was Jagger. You know, he'd always have his eye on what was coming next.
Well, given the way both of their lives were then at that time, it's hardly surprising that we should have a song called Loving Cup. Loving Cup there from the album Exile on Main Street, the Rolling Stones album released 50 years ago today. Pat Carty with me in the studio. I was saying about the country sound that's there in that song as well, Pat, and you were mentioning it. There were a lot of people around Nellcott in the south of France.
I want to go back to your earlier Eagles comment, because someone who was present, you know, in the year before it and also at Nellcott as well, was a fellow called Graham Parsons, who people will know as this kind of country rock legend, who died not long after this album came out, and he was Keith's best mate. Now, you could argue that the Eagles took an awful lot, they did take an awful lot from him, but he was there and he taught Keith the difference between Nashville and Bakersfield. You know, he's playing Merle Haggard songs on the piano with him, George Jones, Till All Hours of the Morning, and a lot of that spills over to this. And there's another thing on that song as well that stands out that is missing from maybe later Rolling Stones records, that you can hear Mick and Keith singing together and to each other. And I think that's a big part of the beauty of this
and
as well.
Keith, you know? There's one of the songs on the album where he takes the lead as well.
Yeah,
isn't there?
Yeah, he does. There's a song called Happy, which he recorded apparently in a few hours. Woke up, had the riff. There was nobody else around. So Jimmy Miller, the producer, played the drums. Bobby Keys was there. He played a bit of sax. And Keith did the rest of it. And job done in 2 hours.
All right, let's finish up then. Mick had been to see Aretha Franklin at the live recording of her Amazing Grace album that year. That's in there on this album, on Exile and Main Street, particularly, I suppose, Pat, on tracks like Shine a Light. Just lead us into it.
Yeah, tracks like Shine a Light. A lot of the work was done. See, the legend is Nellcott, but a lot of work was done in Los Angeles as well when they did the mixing and they did the overdubbing. So it was Jagger who brought in a lot of backing vocalists. And as you say, he was influenced by, he was mate of Bobby Preston, Billy Preston, hanging around with him. And he went to this Aretha recording. You can see him in the movie of that. And so the soul and gospel influences spill into it as well.
And here is Shine a Light. Shine a Light, real gospel sound for sure in that track from Exile on Main Street. Thanks to Pat Carty for helping us celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Rolling Stones album Exile on Main Street. Live music and arts making a storming comeback in 2022. Hugely welcome for a sector that was hit so badly, obviously, in recent years. Glendalough Estate in County Wicklow will play host to one of Ireland's newest music and arts festivals in June. This festival is called Beyond the Pale. James Vincent McMorrow will be there. Loa, Stereo MC, celebrating 30 years since their connected hit album. And also there will be Claire Dunn, star of Kin and her own film. Of course, herself, Emmett Kerwin, will be bringing old Dublin old school back to the stage. Lots to look forward to, clearly. But on the night, or at the festival, will be Soda Blonde, a band whose last album was incredibly well received here on Arena when it was released last August, described by one of our reviewers as broad, ambitious and irresistibly catchy. Well, let's have a listen to one of the tracks that displays all of those qualities. This is Tiny Darkness.
About all I have.
There we go, a little bit of Tiny Darkness. Not, in fact, from the album, because as both Faye O'Rourke and Adam O'Regan, who are sitting opposite me, went, oh, as it started, that's the strings version.
Choice. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It is the strings version of that song. So maybe explain why the strings version even exists, Faye.
Well, Adam You actually arranged those strings. Initially, mm-hmm. we had recorded that with a synth string back in the demo days.
Yeah.
And then we decided we'd go into the studio and work with some incredible violinists and cellists.
And then over December, we decided to release kind of like an EP of kind of alternative kind of versions of the album tracks. And we decided to put out this one with just everything, all the strings and the vocal, but nothing else in it, you know.
Yeah. But it really brings a wonderful quality to the song.
Absolutely,
Those strings underneath it. I mean, he's crying out for the big orchestra to arrange.
I know.
Really,
well, that's
it.
I'm on to the orchestra. I'm on to Joe. Joe, are you listening? It's great because you can really hear how strong the song is when it's stripped back like that. And I think that's a testament to the writing, if I do say so myself.
And how is the writing? What's the division of labour in? I mean, Soda Blonde, born out of Little Green Cards, which was a huge success in its own right. But how's the writing divvied up in terms of Soda Blonde? Would you say, Faye, first of all?
Well, I suppose I would start with the seed of the idea where I'd write a song on, you know, one instrument. That's changing a bit now as we go forward. We would sit around and arrange it together. We're a band, so we'd flesh that out and kick ideas back and forth until we found the right soundscape to fit the tune. Yeah.
But we're very much in that mode right now. We're writing the second album and the process is very much like Faye is locked away in a dungeon and she won't share until she gets things where she, you know, where she kind of feels comfortable sharing. You know, it can be a bit frustrating sometimes for the rest of us because we just want to get in the room and kick things around. But until Faye kind of has the lyrics and kind of the structure where she kind of wants it to be, she doesn't divulge anything.
I feel like the song needs to have a conclusion before it can be
But I presume, Adam, given obviously it's just yourself, Adam O'Regan on guitar, there's Dylan Lynch rather on drums and Donna Seaver O'Leary on bass. Given the success of the debut album, it looks as if that process of Faye in her dungeon bringing this stuff out to you, it works.
Oh yeah, no. Like, well, that's the very first stage. Then we get into a room together, and we all go crazy, and it changes a lot.
I would usually write something that sounds like a ballad, which is never usually kind of the end product at all.
Yeah.
So I mean, and Adam's also not just a guitar player; you're, you know, multi instrumentalist, producer, mixer. We do everything in house, you know. So we're so lucky that we have you. We're so lucky.
Not only do you do all of those things in house, but I was looking at the videos today, particularly what's the one where you're wearing the big Hollywood gown.
Oh yes, Terrible Hands. The David Lynch one.
Yeah.
So just tell you do these videos yourself.
I mean, I can't take all the credit for it. We're a team. Myself and Faye kind of do a lot of brainstorming around what the concept's going to be first, and then goes through a process of storyboarding and production design, and we have a lot of fun with it, you know. I think ultimately...
Well, we have a lot of stress with it.
We have a lot of stress with it, but we have a lot of fun with it.
We're both really ambitious people with no organisation skills.
Yeah,
that's all. And that video was, you know, because Adam's great, you kind of... I have all faith in Adam, but it's always like the most stressful situation before we start, and then it comes out looking great.
Yeah.
And I think you were saying about the debut album that essentially, lyrically and thematically, it was kind of, this is the mess that is your 20s. Except that's what the songs are about in some ways. You're saying that you're beginning to develop stuff now for album number two. What kind of ideas or what kind of themes are coming up?
You know, I think you always make sense of work when it's finished. A lot of those things are still private. And I think with this album, I'm a lot less cryptic. I'm really facing a lot of issues head on. And, you know, it's quite usual for them to be quite dark. So that's one thing. Nothing's changed in that regard, but we're definitely working in a different way. One thing that was good about the pandemic was that we had to work remotely, and we managed to work. We're covering a lot of ground, even though we're not in the same room. So
would you say it's more introspective then? Is there a bit of that about it?
There is, but I think sonically for me, it's been more about exploring soundscapes because I usually sit down with an instrument and just kind of blurt out my feelings and do a lot of emotional mining. Whereas this record, I was really responding to layering sounds and, you know, developing a soundscape first and letting that inform where I'm going lyrically. Yeah. So a lot of that is coming from... You'd be amazed what comes from a subconscious kind of a place. I feel like it's too premature to kind of talk about the themes because, to be honest with you as well, I was writing something today and I actually sent it into the WhatsApp group earlier on, and it was just, I felt like I was really kind of, I was just really, as I said, facing a lot of issues head on, and they're big personal things that I'm still trying to work out.
And I'm looking forward to seeing how you work them in the songs when that time's come.
Yeah.
That time comes. You have, as well as the Beyond the Pale on Saturday, the 11th of June in Wicklow, you're also at the Wild, I think before that, in fact, you're at the Wild Roots Festival in Sligo, and working on the second album. How difficult is it to keep
June
all of those things?
June is going to be an exciting month. We've all blocked this off in our calendar. We've taken time off work, and it's going to be basically the first week is like we're going down to a writing retreat where we're going to refine all of the music that Faye's been working on, that we've been working on remotely. Then we've got that in between that, we've got a bunch of festivals, and then the last 2 weeks we're going into the studio to record. And we've set ourselves.
And would you, I mean, would you be tempted when out on a tour like this, or even at the festival coming up, would you be tempted to kind of sneak in one of the songs from the new album to give it a go in front of people?
I mean,
if we
have something that's at a stage where it's ready to go, it's the only way to road test it is to play it in front of people. Yeah. You know, you completely get the idea if something's in the right place or not based on reaction.
I was given some of the lineup at the festival, Beyond the Pale Festival. Anything? I mean, I don't. When you play your own gig, do you think, right, well, what am I going to go and see, or do you just get into the car and go home? Are you looking forward to anything in particular, Faye?
I mean, that was what we referred to as the cool one. Because Adam was like, which festival are we talking about? Beyond the Pale, and he said, oh, that's the cool one.
Yeah.
So all, I mean, those three headliners are massive, Orbital Fortet,
Bonobo, and Lisa and everything.
Yeah. And I love some Irish artists as well. I can't wait to see AMAC. I'm a huge AMAC fan and a huge John Francis Flynn fan. And the theatre aspect as well. My partner's in theatre, so I haven't seen Dublin Old School or Claire Dunn's show, Effort.
Yeah, it's
so
great.
I'm really
great
looking
title
to
look at on the page and not have to say it on radio.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, it's one of the ones in particular that I think we're going to be sticking around for.
Yeah.
And for you, Adam, are you a fan of the festival attendance as well as playing at it?
Yeah, all the above. A Fortet, especially when we were in school, we all kind of cut our teeth on this one CD that one of my teachers made me and kind of said, like, here, listen to this music. And Fortet was on it, and that album kind of, I can't wait to see.
So a teacher who actually gave you some really good taste.
We all owe a lot of our taste of music to this one mixtape that one of my English teachers gave me back.
Do you mind saying his or her name?
Yeah, Aaron Copeland, if you're listening. We love you.
It's a great name for somebody who likes music.
Not the Aaron Copland.
The American composer.
Aaron Copland.
Let him be. Maybe he is the Aaron Copland.
Yeah.
At any rate, listen, great to speak with you both. Do you know what I'm going to do, actually? Because I didn't get time to play a little bit of Terrible Hands, and there's a great video going with that. And we're going to tweet a link to that video, and people can maybe listen and watch at their own leisure. You're playing Beyond the Pale on Saturday, June the 11th. More tour dates as well, as you told us there, but you get full details of all of those on the website sodablonde.com, and I hope we'll get to talk to you when album number 2 is a little bit further down the line.
Absolutely.